Good day and welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. The Republican Party was born in 1854, and it was born with the purpose of taking on the slave power of the South. Early members of the party came, in part, from the defunct Whig Party, and also from Democrats who opposed slavery. It was the last time a major political party, the Whigs, dissolved and then was replaced by another major party, that being the Republicans. It's now the Republicans and Democratic parties that we still have today, though one can argue that they have switched places on some key issues, though not all of them. Early Republicans in the 1850s agreed on one thing, and that was to stop the expansion of slavery into new territories that were stolen from Mexico and indigenous people. But they differed greatly what to do about slavery once slavery was over. Most Republicans wanted former slaves and even free blacks to be shipped out of the United States and start a new colony elsewhere, in places like Central America, the Caribbean, or Western Africa. For a time, this is what Abraham Lincoln advocated for, and this view was championed by an organization that was known as the American Colonization Society, in which many of the most powerful and influential politicians of the day were members of. But then there were the radical Republicans, who in Congress punched above their weight and who sought full racial equality for African Americans after the Civil War. Some, including the legendary Thaddeus Stevens, called for the redistribution of wealth from former slave masters to former slaves. Today we present part two of a three-part series of our oral history project with preeminent Civil War historian Eric Foner. Eric Foner is the DeWitt Clinton Professor Emeritus of History at Columbia University. His book, The Fiery Trial, Abraham Lincoln and American Slavery, won the Pulitzer Prize. His latest book is called The Second Founding, How the Civil War and Reconstruction Remade the Constitution. Our focus in this program is Abraham Lincoln, the Radical Republicans, and the pick in 1864 of Democrat and white supremacist Andrew Johnson as Lincoln's vice presidential candidate, a decision with major consequences for a post-Civil War world. So without further delay, part two of our conversation with Eric Foner. Let's get into the Republican Party, and let's start to talk perhaps about also Abraham Lincoln. And you have very different factions within the Republican Party that concerned especially race. On one hand, you had radical Republicans led by folks like Thaddeus Stevens of Pennsylvania, who was not just for the abolition of slavery, but was also very much for the full equal rights, for the full racial equality in the United States. And then on the other side of that, and then you have differing, I guess, levels and, you know, layers in between. But on the opposite end of that, you had Republicans who were for the abolition of slavery as well. That's what united them, but wanted nothing to do with former slaves, with black people who supported the colonization of taking former slaves and black people and moving them to other parts of the world, whether it be to Africa or whether it be to Central America. We'll talk more in a moment about the American Colonization Society. But before we do that, where did Abraham Lincoln come down in the spectrum that you would find within the Republican Party?
Well, Lincoln was in the middle, which is often a useful place to be in politics. Lincoln was not a radical. He was not an abolitionist. He never claimed to be one. But he felt he hated slavery. He made that clear. And he felt that this opposition to the spread of slavery was the raison d'etre of the Republican Party. They were people in the Republican Party who didn't care at all about slavery. They just wanted to limit Southern power. Southerners had blocked legislation that many Republicans wanted, like homestead legislation in the West or protective tariffs for industry. Lincoln said, no, that's not our issue. Tariff, forget it. We are opposed to the expansion of slavery, and indeed to its ultimate extinction. We want the ultimate. Now, that may take a long time. That's a vague idea. Lincoln never spelled it out. But it wasn't just stopping the expansion. He talked about a country sometime in the future without slavery at all. As you say, they were radical Republicans who were much more egalitarian on the question of race. Stevens, Charles Sumner, and others. There were many who were racist themselves. Lincoln was not a racial egalitarian, certainly not before the Civil War. And indeed, he was one of those who favored colonization. He said, yeah, these people should become free, but they cannot remain in the United States. Now, why? Why should they leave? What's the problem here? Many black people have been in the United States for several generations. This idea was not unknown. Jefferson had said, we can't free the slaves without getting rid of them all. Why? Well, Jefferson had an answer. He said, if the two races live together as free people, amalgamation will follow. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Jefferson practiced amalgamation with his slave, Sally Hemings, but he was obsessed with preventing that from becoming a widespread phenomenon. Henry Clay, Lincoln's mentor in politics, was the head of the president of the American Colonization Society, devoted to sending free blacks and slaves out of the country. Why? He said, because black people are just degenerate. They're criminal minded. They will run amok if they're freed. They'll be violent. It'll be impossible to have civilization. Lincoln never said anything like that either. He didn't abuse black people. He didn't denounce them. He didn't say they were not as good as white people. So why? Well, Lincoln said, because racism is so deep in this country that black people will never be able to really enjoy their rights. They're entitled to the same natural rights as whites, but they will never enjoy them in the United States. So it's better for them to go to Africa or to Central America or to Haiti or something like that. Now, you know, this idea is sort of an escape from the whole problem. It enables you to think about ending slavery without thinking about what is going to be the status of these black people once they are free. Well, we're going to ship them out of the country. But, you know, people who looked at this said, this is ridiculous. You've got 4 million slaves. You've got 500,000 free blacks. You're going to ship them all out of the country? That's absurd. Moreover, we need labor. Immigrants are coming in. The United States is labor scarce. You can't just send a whole chunk of your laboring population out of the country. So Lincoln is in the middle there, and that gives him a lot of, a position he's just a good political place to be politically, especially in 1860 when they're looking for a candidate who can appeal all across the spectrum of political ideas in the North. He's acceptable to the radicals. He's acceptable to the conservatives. He's in the mainstream of the party. And in a sense, even though he's not as well known as some other Republican leaders, that's what propels him into the Republican nomination for president.
Acceptable, but not necessarily loved by any side.
Well, he was respected partly because he had fought Stephen A. Douglas, who was the most important politician of the 1850s, to a draw, basically, in the great Senate debate, campaign, the Lincoln-Douglas debates of 1858. We remember today Douglas, if we do at all, because he's the guy who debated Lincoln. But in the 1850s, Lincoln was the guy who debated Douglas. Douglas was the number one political leader in the country, and Lincoln had fought him to a draw, and that's what made Lincoln a national figure, that people said, hey, you know, this guy may be a powerful candidate. You know, even I've never heard of him, they say, in the East, but if he could fight Douglas that way, we got to think, you know, he's a plausible candidate.
And Stephen Douglas was the author of the Kansas-Nebraska Act.
Right, exactly. He was the one who pushed through the Kansas-Nebraska Act, shattering the political system. That wasn't what he was trying to do. He was trying to set up a political order there so railroads could be built, so that farmers could move in. Because until you had a territorial government, all sorts of land titles were open to question and laws. But Southerners were saying, I'm sorry, man, we're not going to let you set this up as a territory if slavery is just banned from there. And he had to kind of finesse the sectional conflict, which he, of course, didn't do very successfully.
And I find the nominating convention for the Republicans in 1860 to be very interesting. And the plank that they end up taking, and this is Lincoln's position as well as presidential candidate, is that we are against the spread of slavery to new states, but we are going to respect, even if we don't like it, the institution of slavery in the states that already have it.
Right. Well, what's interesting is, yeah, they are trying to appear as moderate as they can. They're not abolitionists. They're not John Brown, certainly, trying to set off an invasion of the South, you know, to liberate the slaves. And moreover, as I said before, it was universally assumed that the federal government could not just abolish slavery in the states. When they said we respect the right of Southern states to have slavery if they want, that's the Constitution. You know, there's nothing you can do about that. And Lincoln was a constitutionalist, if anything. Lincoln said, look, we've got to abide by the Fugitive Slave Law, which is a terrible law. It's unjust. Everyone knows it's unjust. We've got to abide by it. Why? Because the Constitution says Southerners have to be able to get back their fugitive slaves. And if we start annulling one part of the Constitution, other parts will follow and the whole system will fall apart. But remember, the position of stopping, it may seem to us, compared to abolitionists, these guys are kind of milquetoast, you know? They're just interested in stopping the expansion of slavery. But it was the election of Lincoln that triggered the Civil War, right? Not John Brown. He wasn't running by then. That was not acceptable to the South. That was just as unacceptable as abolitionism was. So, you know, this was a red line for them, and they were not willing to deal with a guy who wanted to stop the expansion of slavery. Forget about what he said about slavery in the states.
So we begin to see the succession of Southern states, beginning with South Carolina, with the election of Lincoln, even before he takes office?
Well, before he takes office, yes. Lincoln is elected in November. Back then, the president didn't take office until the following March 4th. There was like a four-month gap between the election and inauguration. Today, it's in January, a little closer in. But one after another, the Deep South states, you know, there were like 15 slave states, okay? Seven of them, I think, seven of them, the Deep South, the Cotton States, South Carolina, Georgia, Florida, Alabama, Mississippi, etc., they seceded right off, Texas, they seceded right off within the next, within 2 months of Lincoln's election. But there were still eight slave states that didn't do anything, didn't secede. The Upper South, Virginia, Maryland, Tennessee, Arkansas, etc., they were waiting to see what would happen. And so Lincoln has this very delicate situation. He doesn't want to do anything that's going to propel any more states to secede. On the other hand, he can't just accept the idea that a state can just walk away because it doesn't like the result of a presidential election. So he plays a very cagey game in that period, particularly between when he's elected and when he is inaugurated as president. But when Lincoln is elected, as I said, seven slave states have said, we're out, and we formed a new government, the Confederate States of America. Eight slave states are still in the Union waiting to see what happens.
Did those states that first left right after the election, did they warn they were going to leave if Lincoln won the election?
Oh, they've been warning it for years. Absolutely, yeah. For years. Ever since the Republican Party was put into being, Southerners say, hey, forget this. If these guys get elected, we're leaving. We will not accept the government. Now, of course, they've done it so many times that a lot of Northerners said, this is just bluff, man. These guys have been yakking on for years, and they've never done anything. So you don't have to worry about it. They're just trying to intimidate us, you know, frighten us with this rhetoric. Lincoln himself, I think, exaggerated the degree of devotion to the Union in the South. He seemed to feel that the secession was like a conspiracy of a small number of people who had kind of hoodwinked the general population, and that if he just tried to delay and, you know, kind of not do anything extreme, that the Unionist sentiment in the South would reassert itself and secession would kind of collapse from within. Didn't happen that way, though.
Again, this is the Lincoln, the moderate, not the Lincoln that would be remembered as the emancipator later on, as Lincoln.
But, you know, but remember, Lincoln could have avoided the Civil War very easily by just giving in to what the South wanted. If Lincoln didn't care about slavery, why didn't he say, all right, we'll let you expand, or we'll make a deal. You expand half of the territories, we'll take the other half. No, Lincoln refused. In other words, he's a moderate, but he's also steadfast on that one principle. I was elected to stop the westward expansion of slavery, and I'm going to do it. Why? Why do you have to do it? Well, you know, he had this correspondence in December 1860 with Alexander Stevens, who he had known when they were both members of Congress, Stevens from Georgia, who will soon become the vice president of the Confederacy. And at the end of one of these letters, Lincoln says, you know, here's the problem. We think slavery is wrong, and you think slavery is right. Well, if that's the problem, is there a solution? Is there a compromise to that problem? No. So, don't overestimate Lincoln's moderation. He is moderate on specific policy, but not on the fundamental question of the evil of slavery.
Was it seen at the time, or even seen now, that the expansion of slavery was necessary in order for the South to maintain its system?
Was it necessary?
Yeah.
I think historians are very uncertain about that. The South was doing pretty well, you know, and there was a lot of unoccupied land, especially in Texas. There were millions and millions of acres that were not cultivated that slavery could have moved on to. Slavery has been used in all sorts of systems, in mining, in manufacturing, and, you know, I think the danger to slavery was political more than economic. In that there was tremendous world demand for cotton, and that wasn't going to go away. But if the Republican Party succeeded in stopping the westward expansion of slavery, then little by little the South would become a shrinking minority in the country. You'd have more and more free states coming into the Union, and the Southern hold on national power would disintegrate.
Did the South at the time see it as necessary to expand?
Some people did, and some people didn't. That was another easy way out of the problem. That there were many Northerners who said, oh, we're going to stop the expansion of slavery, and it'll sort of collapse from within. You know, we'll surround them with free states, and then they'll just die off, the slavery. Well, why? Well, why would slavery die off surrounded by free states? People still needed that cotton. What did it matter? As I say, it's a political matter almost as much as an economic matter. But then saying that, you have to immediately add, but why is the politics important? New England lost a lot of its political power in the early part of the Republic. They didn't secede, you know. They seemed to survive pretty well. The reason that regional political power was essential was because of slavery, you know, because they had to protect the institution of slavery. If they didn't have slavery, it wouldn't have mattered how much national power they had. So, as Lincoln said, I'm paraphrasing here, in his second inaugural address, let us get serious, everybody. Slavery was the cause of the war. Everybody knew slavery was the cause of the war back then. A lot of people don't know it anymore, but it was.
Was it seen as the cause? Because you just said Lincoln said that in his second inaugural address. At the beginning
right.
of the Civil War, did the North see it as a war?
No.
To eradicate slavery?
No, you're right. Some people did and some people didn't. Of course, the rhetoric at the beginning of the war was, this is a war for the Union. Lincoln said that right off. We are not fighting to get rid of slavery. We are fighting to preserve the nation. Moreover, the Confederacy made this a serious error, I think, of firing the first shot. So Lincoln, we are under attack by these guys. We're not trying to coerce them, but they have attacked us. They have bombarded Fort Sumter, you know, and therefore we must defend the nation, defend the flag, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But even early on in the war, very early on, there were people saying, you know, to win this war, there's only one way to win this war, and that's to get rid of slavery. Slavery is what enables them to keep armies in the field. You know, you can't win this war as just a war of army against army. It's got to become a war of society against society with slavery as a target. That's what the radicals said, Stevens, Sumner. At the beginning, they were a minority, but as time goes on, more and more Northerners come to say, you know, these guys are right.
And it's interesting to see the divisions within the North and within those who are executing the North on how they viewed the war, including with Lincoln's top general, McClellan, who was against.
McClellan was a Democrat. He was a racist. He was an egomaniac. Yes, McClellan did not understand the number one principle of the military in a democratic society, which is the subordination of the military to the civilian. When Lincoln issued the preliminary Emancipation Proclamation in 1862, McClellan issued a letter to the troops basically saying people should go and vote Democratic in the coming fall elections in order to rebuke Lincoln for this thing, you know? The remedy is at the polls. And he condemned the preliminary Emancipation Proclamation. Fast forward a few months when Lincoln issues the final Emancipation Proclamation, General Ulysses S. Grant, who has a different outlook, says to his troops, look, whether you agree with this or not, this is the policy of the government. And the role of the military is to implement the policy of the government. He calls his generals together and he says, look, the Emancipation Proclamation has authorized the enrollment of black men in the Union Army. I know a lot of you guys don't want that. Resign. This is now the policy of the government. If you're not able to carry out the policy of the government, resign. So Grant was absolutely clear, civilian control. McClellan thought that he was a kind of aspiring president, and in fact he ran for president in 1864 as
against
a Democratic candidate.
Yeah.
Against Lincoln. Yeah. So, you know, those are two different attitudes about what the role of a general is.
And then you have other generals that are going farther towards abolition than Lincoln as president is at the time, including John C. Fremont.
You've got radical generals, John C. Fremont out in Missouri early on, I think in August or September 1861. You know, he issues his own little Emancipation Proclamation declaring free all the slaves in Missouri. He says, you know, there's a kind of guerrilla war going on in Missouri. Fremont is not that great a general. He's not able to keep it under control. He says, all right, we're going to free the slaves and that'll weaken the other side. Now, Lincoln, one thing Lincoln is very adamant about is keeping control of the slavery issue. You know, he leaves a lot of stuff to Congress. They're passing all sorts of far-reaching legislation, banking legislation, railroad legislation, taxation, currency, really important. But Lincoln doesn't pay a lot of attention to that. That's up to the Congress. It's up to the Secretary of the Treasury. But when it comes to slavery, he's the one who will make the decision. So he says to Fremont, look, you got to rescind that order because it's way beyond what the law at the moment will allow. Fremont refuses. So Lincoln orders him to repeal to rescind the order and then chucks him out, fires him. David Hunter, 1862, does the same thing in South Carolina and North Carolina, where he declares slavery abolished in his military command. And Lincoln again tells him he can't do that. So Lincoln wants the process of dealing with slavery to go along as he sees fit. Not he can't have generals making policy over this fundamental issue.
What role do radical Republicans in Congress play in directing the war and how the war would eventually be seen as a war for abolition of slavery?
Well, the radical Republicans are very, very important. They are not a majority. Most members of Congress are moderate, you might say, moderate Republicans. The radicals are like almost the liaison in the political system of the abolitionists. They're very close. Most abolitionists are not really part of the political system. They're moral agitators. They're out there campaigning to change public opinion. And one thing important to remember about Lincoln deals with radicals all the time. He knows they're important. To use a modern phrase, they're part of the base of the Republican Party. You can't win with just your base, but you certainly can't just kick your base out either. You've got to hear what they have to say. And Lincoln has very good personal relations with a lot of radicals, Charles Sumner, Owen Lovejoy from Illinois, quite a few others. Lincoln understands that the radicals and he are going in the same direction, even though they're going a lot faster than he is. Now, in a crisis, and this is the greatest crisis in American history, people with a clear agenda may have much more power than their numbers might suggest. They have an answer to the problem. Stevens puts it forward right off. Here's what we have to do. We've got to abolish slavery. We've got to arm black troops. We've got to occupy the South. You're not going to win the war without doing that, folks. He said many people think these Southerners will give up after a battle. No, they're not going to. This is going to be a long, bloody war. Are we ready for it? Well, at the beginning, a lot of people aren't. They say, Stevens, you're crazy. Arming black soldiers? We can't. They don't know how to fight. That's ridiculous. They'll run away the first time they see a white soldier. By 1862, people are saying, Stevens has a point here. We don't, this is a bloody war. Enlistment is beginning to wane. We need every man we can get out there. So if black people are willing to serve, fine. And the fact that he's proved right once means people are going to listen to him the next time. So all through the Civil War Reconstruction, the radicals exert influence, not because they dominate the political system, but because they've got a clear agenda and nobody else does. That's the problem. How are you going to win this war without abolishing slavery? There's no way.
The radicals are not a majority, even within the Republican Party, but they play an outsized role within the party, within what happens in Congress. Thaddeus Stevens, somebody that you keep mentioning, one of the leading radical Republicans.
Yes, great.
Wasn't he even called the dictator of Congress?
Well, here you get into a long discussion, which probably we don't want to go into, of historiography. For many, many years, when the South controlled the narrative of the Civil War, which basically was up to not that long ago, the Civil War was not about slavery. It was a Northern effort to suppress the local rights of Southerners. Reconstruction was a vindictive effort by people like Stevens, who hated the South, to punish them after the war. These measures, which they hated, the Southerners hated, emancipation, black suffrage, came because of the dictatorship. Stevens forced the Congress to go along. That's ridiculous. There was no dictator of Congress. Stevens was influential, but his cherished idea of seizing the land of the slave owners and distributing some of it to the former slaves never got within any remote chance of passage. So he couldn't just tell Congress what to do.
How would you describe the relationship between, and you mentioned that Abraham Lincoln had good relationships with other radicals, including Charles Sumner, who was in the Senate. What was his relationship like with Thaddeus Stevens?
I don't think he had nearly as much, of a relationship with Stevens as he did with Sumner, partly because he liked to have Sumner take his wife out, Sumner's a very cultured guy. His wife was a very cultured woman, and he was pretty busy most of the time. And he liked to have Sumner come along and take his wife to the theater, take his wife to the opera, go out, to do things, keep her entertained if you'd let them do. So he was personally saw a lot of Sumner. It's too bad that in April 1865, he hadn't somehow asked Sumner to take his wife to the theater, But I don't know that he had that much to do with Stevens, actually. But, of course, he knew Stevens was an important guy in Congress. I don't mean to say he had lacked power. He was the floor leader for many years of the Republicans, chairman of the Ways and Means Committee. In other words, he kind of helped to control what came before, what was voted on the floor of the House. But I don't remember a lot of interchange, really, between Lincoln and Stevens. As I said, many of the things that Stevens was interested in about economic legislation, Lincoln didn't seem to have much to do with.
But Thaddeus Stevens played an important role as chair of the House Ways and Means Committee because he was controlling the purse strings, right? And also the money for the war.
Yeah. And so I think Salmon Chase, the Secretary of the Treasury, had a lot more to do with Stevens there.
Salmon Chase is a really interesting person as well, another radical Republican. Can you tell me about him and the contribution that he made, whether if it was right or not? There's a debate over it. But Salmon P. Chase brought this argument that you write about, that the founders, Jefferson, all these folks that even though they were slave owners themselves, were for the eventual abolition of slavery.
Yeah, well, Chase was trying in the before the Civil War as a lawyer, was trying to work out an anti-slavery political stance that was fully constitutional. There were abolitionists that said, hey, look, Congress can just abolish slavery if it feels like. But very few people thought that was viable under the Constitution. Chase's argument was that the Constitution was neither pro-slavery nor anti-slavery, but that it left slavery purely a creature of local law. Again, I said this before, a state could have slavery if it wanted, or could abolish slavery if it wanted. But outside of state boundaries, no slavery. The federal government has no right to establish slavery under its own jurisdiction. Where is that? Washington, D.C., and the territories, and, you know, like some forts and things like that. So his argument was it's not just stopping the westward expansion of slavery, it's separating the federal government completely from slavery. The federal government under the Constitution should have nothing to do with slavery. And that becomes really the official position of the Republican Party. Now, most of them are mostly interested in this question of the territories, but if you read the Republican national platforms of 1856 and 1860, you'll find Chase's view in there, separation of the federal government from slavery in every way. As to whether the founders were anti-slavery or not, well, you know, you can choose what evidence you want. They put a lot of emphasis on the Northwest Ordinance of 1787, which was enacted by Congress right around the time the Constitution was being written, and that barred slavery in the old Northwest, in Ohio, Illinois, et cetera, et cetera. That's the view of the Founding Fathers, they said. Lincoln himself, in his Cooper Union Address of 1860, it was almost like an MA thesis. It was full of quotes from founders to show they didn't like slavery. And with footnotes, when it was published as a political speech, it had footnotes. You know, the very few political speeches have that. But he was trying to use this research to show that the founders really were against slavery. But in order to create a union, they had to make compromises with slavery. That was Lincoln's argument. Now, of course, many Democrats said that's ridiculous. They protected slavery all over the place. They passed a fugitive slave law. They tried to get slaves back who had run away to the British during the American Revolution. You can't say the founders had no interest in slavery. Well, you know, so this was a political debate. But Chase was very influential in developing the Republican outlook on this.
Eric Foner, in preparing for our conversation, I read several books, actually, including your own, The Fiery Trial, but also a book by Hans Treffus in his biography on Thaddeus Stevens. And Hans Treffus seems to suggest that Thaddeus Stevens was oftentimes frustrated with Abraham Lincoln. And it seems as though Treffus believed that Thaddeus Stevens didn't fully appreciate what Lincoln was doing, wasn't necessarily disagreeing with Thaddeus Stevens, but that Lincoln had a better sense of what was practical at the time and not trying to move too fast, as fast as Thaddeus Stevens wanted him to. Do you think, is that your sense of how Lincoln approached the radicals?
Not really.
Actually. I didn't get that sense.
That's a very common view. I think it's a circular argument. You start out by saying that Lincoln is this great pragmatist, great politician. Therefore, whatever Lincoln decides to do is the practical thing to do. Therefore, anyone who criticizes Lincoln is by definition impractical, visionary, doesn't understand the political situation. The first point is Lincoln was no better or worse than anyone else in understanding the political situation. Lincoln for 10 years advocated this idiotic idea of colonizing all the black people out of the country. That wasn't very practical. Thaddeus Stevens said that's ridiculous. Stevens was the practical guy there. What about assuming that there were all these unionists in the South who would rise up and stop secession? Lincoln was waiting for that. Stevens said, no, forget that. These Southerners are rebels, and we got to fight them on that basis. Lincoln was wrong again. So, in other words, and Lincoln was right on some things also, of course, but I'm just saying that you can't posit Lincoln as the model of practicality in order to cast a shadow on everybody else. Who knows whether, you know, Lincoln couldn't move immediately to emancipation because it was politically unviable. Well, that's what he did. Do we know that if he had declared, if he had issued the Emancipation Proclamation in the first week of the war, that maybe the war would have ended sooner? Who knows? So certainly enrolling black troops in the army, he waited quite a while for that. So I think it's wrong. I think what you have to do, yes, Lincoln as president had many pressures on him, which Stevens didn't as, just a member of Congress. But I think, as I said before, Lincoln understood that he and people like Stevens were heading in the same direction. And every single policy that Lincoln adopted had first been put forward by a guy like, by radical Republicans. First of all, refusing to give in to secession, emancipating the slaves, arming black soldiers, and by the end of the war saying, I'm in favor of some black men voting. Every one of those positions, Lincoln was following what radicals had put out to begin with. So I think you have to have a much more complex, or maybe it's a symbiotic relationship. Lincoln is influencing Stevens. Stevens is influencing Lincoln.
So it is symbiotic. It's not just that then also Republicans were pushing Lincoln. And I say Republicans, right. I mean radical Republicans, but I even mean, obviously, Frederick Douglass.
Well, Douglass, of course, was pushing Lincoln and was very, like Stevens, in the early days of the war, he was very critical of Lincoln and used some very strong language when Lincoln was biding his time on emancipation and then on black soldiers. And, you know, but Douglass, one thing about Lincoln that I found interesting when I was writing this book was that Lincoln is really the first president to meet with black people in the White House. He met with Douglass, but he met with many other blacks, churchmen, Martin Delaney, other black abolitionists. Lincoln was not, you know, he shared some of the racial prejudices of his time, but he was not a visceral racist like, for example, Andrew Johnson, who came after him, was. He didn't mind sitting down and meeting with black people and talking to them. And in fact, I think his meetings with these people actually helped to change his racial attitude. He had never encountered—in Illinois, there were very, very few black people when Lincoln was growing up there, and racism was deep. Illinois had a law in the 1850s prohibiting any black person from entering the state. They didn't want any black people out there. Lincoln didn't have a lot of experience with the kind of—with a Frederick Douglass, a black person who was, you know, so self-educated, but educated and— articulate and understood politics so well. In fact, I think Lincoln and Douglass saw each other as kind of kindred spirits. You know, both of them had been born way down the social scale. Both of them were totally self-educated. Lincoln had only 1 year of formal schooling in his whole life. Douglass had none. Both of them were great orators. Both of them were inspired by the Declaration of Independence. I think Lincoln and Frederick Douglass really saw each other as similar types in a way, despite the vast differences between them.
Can you tell me about the meeting between Frederick Douglass, other black leaders, and Abraham Lincoln in 1862, in which Abraham Lincoln brought this idea that that black people should colonize to either Central America
Douglass,
or Africa?
Douglass wasn't actually at that meeting.
Oh, Douglass was not.
But it was a group of church leaders from Washington, D.C., August 1862. And, yeah, Lincoln brought at that point, Lincoln is really planning to go after slavery. You know, he's already told his cabinet a month before that we're going to have to emancipate the slaves to win this war. But he's still tied to this colonization idea, and he brings it to this black delegation, and he says, look, it's Lincoln's lowest point in the eyes of many people. You know, he says, basically, you're the cause of the Civil War. Without your people being here, there would be no war. Instead of saying slavery is the cause of the war, he says it's black people being here that's the cause of the war. He goes on to say that slavery is the greatest wrong ever suffered by any people. That's pretty strong. Slavery, your people are suffering the greatest wrong ever suffered by any people. But there is a prejudice against you here that will make it impossible for you to ever achieve equality. Whether it is right or wrong, I will not say. So he will condemn slavery in the strongest terms, but as to racism, whether it is right or wrong, I will not say. It's just a fact, and they have to deal with it. How do they deal with it? By leaving the country, according to him. Well, some blacks said, yeah, you're right, Lincoln, but most said, forget it. We were born here. We're Americans. We're demanding our rights in the United States. We have as much right to be here, Lincoln, as you do, and we're not going anywhere. You know, colonization basically falls apart by 1863. It's no longer being pushed by Lincoln.
Didn't Lincoln at that meeting also, at least the way it was interpreted, blame, in some sense, black people for the Civil War?
Well, as I said, it's your presence. It's the presence of your people that is the cause of the war. Is that blaming them or just saying that's a fact? I don't know. But certainly Douglas was pretty annoyed about that when he read it in the newspaper.
And you write that there were reports that from what Lincoln said, I think in New York, that there were reports of violence inflicted upon black people because of what Lincoln said, or at least inspired by what Lincoln
said.
Well,
yeah. This was a period with racial violence in the North. I mean, the biggest was later on, the New York City draft riots of 1863, where black people were lynched on the street. But certainly in many towns in the North, there was small-scale racist violence, and some black people said Lincoln's words saying black people are really aliens in this country, saying they should leave the country, saying their presence is the cause of the war, has helped to stimulate racist violence. Now, Lincoln didn't intend that, but he didn't think very clearly about what the possible consequences of his words might be at that moment.
When I was reading about that part in your book, The Fiery Trial, I couldn't help but think about the power of the bully pulpit that the president has, and even thinking about how we've seen, I think, language from our current president and today ignite.
Well, I don't really think it's very wise to mention Lincoln and Trump in the same sentence. But yes, and that's why, again, it's not quite right, as many people used to write, that, you know, the radicals are pushing Lincoln. When Lincoln says things, it's important. Lincoln helps to create public sentiment, too, as president, as having that bully pulpit. And he does so all through the war. He doesn't go around giving speeches very frequently, but he issues these public letters, which newspapers publish, which, you know, explain and argue in favor of federal policy. And as time goes on, they become much more sympathetic to black people, let's put it that way. I think that the service of black soldiers has a very, very big impact on Lincoln. He comes to feel that they are their role was essential in winning the Civil War, and also that, you know, that's one of the reasons he drops this idea of sending people out of the country. You don't put people in the army, ask them to die for the country, and then tell the survivors you got to leave. You know, that's a different gestalt. By the end of the war, he's saying that the black soldiers ought to have the right to vote, which is quite a shift for him from pre-war views.
Yeah, the evolution of Lincoln, and we're going to get more into that as well as to what happens and the role that the army plays in this story and in the story after. But I do want to ask one last question about the colonization movement. There was one attempt under Lincoln's presidency of colonization that went horribly bad.
Yeah, that was in this island, Île aux Vaches, Island of the Cows, off of Haiti, where Lincoln kind of made a deal with some shady operator to bring 400 or 500 blacks down there. These were refugees who had fled the plantations and were, under Union control. And they were sent down there, and it was a gigantic mess. The guy who organized it was a scoundrel. He had said he'd built all this housing and everything for them, and there was nothing there. And, it was a disaster. Many of them died. And a year later, Lincoln sent a naval vessel to bring back the ones who survived. So that was the sad, the sad outcome of all this talk about colonization.
Yeah, basically the end of the idea of colonization, and, mm-hmm. and certainly the end of Lincoln's support of colonization.
Yeah. Well, after issuing the Emancipation Proclamation on January 1st, 1861, Lincoln never again mentioned colonization publicly.
I want to ask you about the 1864 presidential election, and this is still, the Civil War is still going on at this period of time. And something that I think is just really consequential for what happens later on, and that is Abraham Lincoln and the party itself drops the previous vice president, Hannibal Hanlon, who is an abolitionist mm-hmm. himself, for Andrew Johnson.
Well, I'm not sure I'd go that far. He was anti-slavery. I don't think of Hanlon. But yes, he's definitely anti-slavery.
So there's a difference.
They put Andrew Johnson on the ticket. The first thing you have to remember is nobody wanted to be vice president. Hamlin was perfectly happy. He was given a much better job, collector of the port of Boston, which was a very lucrative job because every ship coming in had to pay the collector something for tariffs and all this. And somehow some of that money used to always get into the pocket of the collector. So you're much better off being collector of the port of Boston than being vice president of the United States, who has nothing to do except wait for the president to die. When Lincoln issued the preliminary Emancipation Proclamation, he got a letter from Hamlin saying, oh, this is a great idea. Really good work, Lincoln. I like that. In other words, he hadn't even consulted with his vice president over this. So, Andrew Johnson is put on not because anyone thought he might become president. Lincoln's a young guy. He's in his 50s, you know, but because he represented a group that the Republican Party was hoping to appeal to, which was pro-union white Southerners. Johnson was a very courageous guy in defending the Union. He was the only senator from a seceding state who stayed in his seat when the war began. He became military governor of Tennessee under Lincoln's appointment, and many, many Northerners. And he spoke he sounded like a radical. And he talked about punishing traitors and, you know, how, and eventually he would say, I'm going to lead the black people. I'll be your Moses to the blacks of Tennessee. You know, I will lead you out of slavery into freedom. We'll talk a little bit more. But the problem was that Johnson was deeply, deeply racist and actually had no interest whatsoever in the rights of the emancipated slaves. Nobody quite knows exactly how Johnson got on the ticket. Lincoln claims that he left it up to the Republican convention to choose whoever they wanted. But Lincoln was also a savvy politician, and it seems like behind the scenes he made it clear that he thought that Johnson would be a good idea to replace Hannibal Hamlin.
Yeah, and they don't even run in 1864 as a Republican Party, right? I mean, it's now the Union Party, the Union ticket.
They call themselves the Union Party to try to broaden the party's appeal, yeah.
And this is the idea of it's one. I guess what you're trying to portray here is this is one country still, North and South. This is, as the name would suggest, the Union Party. And that was the appeal mm-hmm. of bringing on Andrew Johnson, who did not leave the Senate with the Civil War, and actually become military governor of Tennessee.
Right.
Yeah. But as you were saying, it becomes so consequential later on.
Unexpectedly consequential, no question.
Because Lincoln would be assassinated just after the end of the Civil War.
Right.
Yeah. Do you think that it would have been different if they did not bring on Andrew Johnson as vice president, if they would have kept Hannibal Hamlin?
Hannibal Hamlin is a kind of funny guy. We don't know a heck of a lot about him. Yes, he was anti-slavery. The problem of Reconstruction would have taxed any president, Lincoln himself included. I think Hamlin would not have gotten himself into the fix that Andrew Johnson did with getting himself impeached. I mean, Hamlin was a fixture of the Republican Party. He could work with Congress, with Andrew Johnson couldn't. He, you know, was aware of Northern public sentiment, which Johnson wasn't. What would have happened, and it's really almost impossible to say, but I think you wouldn't have had the gigantic conflict between Congress and the president that worked out over Reconstruction under Johnson's presidency.
Yeah. How would you describe Lincoln's views on race and where they would evolve to by the end of the Civil War?
Well, as I said, Lincoln started out, Lincoln was never a racist in a modern sense. I know it's hard to say that. Some of the statements he made seem very racist, but actually he said very little about race. Lincoln's critique of slavery was not about race one way or the other. It was about slavery as a violation of democracy, a violation of opportunity, things like that. Race was just not a major category of Lincoln's thought. I know it's hard. It's impossible for us who are obsessed with race to really, kind of register that. In the 1858 campaign against Stephen Douglas, yes, Lincoln said these oft-quoted thing: I do not believe in black equality. I do not believe they should have the right to vote. I do not believe they should hold office, et cetera, et cetera. That was the position of the Republican Party in Illinois. During the Civil War, my view is his opinions evolved, as I said, partly through meeting black people, partly because of the logic of the war itself, the logic of emancipation, black soldiers. I think Lincoln had the capacity to grow. That's the main point. His racial prejudices were not so deeply ingrained that he was unable to move forward. So I think he developed a great sense of compassion for the former slaves. As I said, he valued enormously the contribution of black soldiers. And by the end, in his final speech, he's talking about voting for black men, some, the more educated and the soldiers in the South. And, that's a time when only 5 northern states allowed black people to vote. So Lincoln's ahead of the curve by that time. It took a while for the rest of the North to catch up to allowing any blacks to vote.
And that concludes part 2 of our 3-part oral history project with preeminent Civil War historian Eric Foner of Columbia University. Tomorrow for part 3, we focus on Andrew Johnson, the impeachment of Andrew Johnson, Reconstruction, and the constitutional amendments that would shape even our own world today.